You took our daughter. You and Gwen, you conspired with that monstrous woman. There was a sudden energy in his face, and his shoulders jerked forward.
No, Katie, he said. It wasn't like that. The boosters outvoted me. They wanted me to meet with him, and I knew you wouldn't like it.
A sound skidded up from inside her throat to stop him.
You're lying, she said. I saw Molly. She didn't know about any of this. All you do is lie.
The weight, the bigness of the words excited her. They seldom fought, not really. So it was all here now, and she kept going about how he had lied and lied again. And is this about Gwen Weaver? And if so, what kind of man are you to let her tell you? And what a thing to do. Shanghaiing our daughter behind my back, almost like a kidnapping. And then the words had a powerful thunder to them, and she said them again and again. Like a kidnapping. Like a kidnapping. And as she was saying it, an equally powerful sinking feeling of what she couldn't say.
How could you two keep secrets from me?
You and Devon. Thrusting that thought to the corner of her hot brain, she just kept going. And you lied about where you were, and left your sick son. And you lied about what you've been doing with our daughter, and you left me here all alone.
Katie, stop. Stop and listen. I needed to meet the guy. Ehlers. I needed to see Devon with him. I needed to see if it might work, if they connected. I needed to fix this to make everything right again.
Everything right?
For fuck's sake, Eric, she said.
A way of talking she barely remembered, hadn't used since she was a teenager, and that teenager way of playing with words like flung rubber bands. You're talking about qualifiers and gyms and coaches when all this is going on? He jumped up, the metal of the chair sparking, the bottle keeling between his sneakers, his arm diving down as it crashed. A light went on somewhere. A dog howled. A screen door banged shut.
But this is what's going on, Katie. Not something that happened to a kid we barely know. This is about Devon. I can't believe I have to tell you that.
He paused, and then he said it.
You never cared as much as we did. You were always ready to give up.
There it was. There it was.
How dare you,
she said, her voice low and ugly.
How dare you, Eric, after everything. We've always been in this together.
Turning from her, his chin tilted up in a way that felt strangely church-like, a reminder of vows taken, he said,
I know. I'm sorry. I know.
And they both sat for a moment, the yard black with the quality of witchy mystery it had had years ago, the first time a patch of browning green was all theirs, before patios, before the maze of all-weather tumbling mats, before the trampoline, and the smaller trampoline before that. Before the lawnmower, when it was a place that was outside, but private, and wild, but safe. Empty garden beds and rambling ivy, and a dented air conditioner stained with black walnut husks. But it was beautiful, and theirs. And she almost said it. She almost said, "Our daughter was sleeping with Ryan Beck." But she couldn't make the words come. Then they were both drinking, a half pint of black velvet Eric dug out of the kitchen cupboard. He was roaming around the firefly-studded yard while she sat thinking bad thoughts. How you can be married to someone your whole life, it feels like, and not know them at all.
You never cared as much as we did. I did the right thing, Katie, he said. I did what I had to because this is what matters.
Pointing to the yard, the house, Devon's bedroom window, lightless and lonely.
This is about our girl. Our girl, helping her get everything she wants. Which is what we always said we'd do.
That's not good enough, Eric, she said, rising from the squeaking lawn chair. We're in this together, we promised, way back when. But now she was drunk, and her foot caught in the rust-pocked frame, and she fell against him, and he caught her. And she held on to him so tightly, the smell of his shirt, her face pressed against it, feeling the heave of his heart. She was so drunk. When he half-carried her inside the house, they were both out of their minds, her foot banging against the doorframe, cutting her ankle. Her ankle was bleeding and felt warm and cold at the same time. and they nearly fell on the stairs, her back hitting the handrail and his foot slipping on the carpeted steps. They were on the bed, barely. It was fast, and they might not even have shut the door. It was fast, and she could feel the blood from her ankle running down her leg, flung in the air. His face pressed so hard against her, teeth clicking, heads knocking each other. The sound that came from him only sometimes, once in a great while. A pressure so overwhelming and a relief so immense that his body racked and fevered, and she felt herself in the center of something ugly and breathtaking. Even as it was happening, she knew that in the morning she wouldn't remember what they had done, and if it had been different than ever before. All she'd remembered was that she felt a shiver, a cold hush all through, and later an unbearable heat that shamed her. Married a long time, you think there will never be any surprises again, at least not those kinds. But you are wrong. She pulled the sheets up over herself. Her chest was making a funny noise, and she couldn't get anything in her lungs. Inhaling, exhaling, her palm on her chest. She hadn't even felt him pull away, sit up. Turning her head, her neck still throbbing, her legs still shaking, she saw he was already sitting up on the edge of the bed, looking out the window into the pitch-black backyard, the garage's graying gable. "I'm just trying to protect her from all this," he said. "From all these distractions." "A boy died," she started, her voice almost like a chant. "A boy died." "Ryan," he said, not turning around. "Ryan, I know you love to talk about Ryan."
"What?"
Rubbing her face, trying to think.
"Loved to talk about
that kid," he said. "That kid, the way everyone looked at him." He turned around and faced her, leaning toward her.
"The way you looked at him," he said.
"What?"
Katie said, wondering if this was really happening, the whiskey soaking through her.
"Fuck that kid," he said. "Fuck that kid and his beautiful face. That's Teddy's problem. And that psychotic niece of his, that's his problem too. Fuck that kid. Who cares about that kid?"
A coldness dropped through her.
"You know who cares?"
She took a breath and said it.
"Your daughter."
It excited her to say it.
"Your daughter loved that boy. Your daughter was sleeping with that boy."
"What?" he said, so quiet she barely heard him.
"What did you say?" "I said they were sleeping together." Haley must have found out. "They were sleeping together, and that started all of this."
He wouldn't look at her, turning back to the window, to the yard's depths, the open maw of the garage. The excitement in her chest twisted into something else.
"Eric,"
she said.
"Did you know about them?"
He spun around slowly and looked at her like he had no idea what she was talking about.
"No," he said, shaking his head. "No. Katie, I swear."
That's when she knew he was lying. And she said, "You either tell me everything, or you leave now." And then he was gone.
"Katie, why are you calling me? It's 2 o'clock in the morning."
But Gwen sounded awake. She probably never slept at all, like a bullfrog or a shark.
"Go wake up my daughter, Gwen. She's not answering her phone. Wake her up and tell her I'm coming to get her."
"You need to settle down, Katie. There's no reason.
Get her up! She's coming home now."
Grabbing for her sneakers, one eye on Drew's open bedroom door, Katie could hear him breathing deeply, his hanging solar system tilting above him. Styrofoam planets, Saturn's rings coated in dust.
"Katie," Gwen was saying, "have you been drinking?
I know what you've been doing with my daughter. Have her waiting on your front steps."
There was a brief pause. 5 minutes, Gwen said, and hung up. The lights at the Weaver house all seemed to come on at once, the instant Katie's car touched the foot of the long drive. At the glowing rectangle of the front door, Devon stood poised.
"Mom,"
she called out, duffel bag in one hand and backpack in the other, both swinging, whipping around her as she skidded down the long slope, hair flying, flip-flops and her sleep shorts, a sweatshirt yanked over her bolt-tight frame, thoroughbred legs gripping the blue carpet of the lawn.
I can't talk about anything now.
They were still in the car, in the garage, and Katie's voice was louder than she'd ever known it, louder than Coach T's, her own clamorous mother's, anyone's.
We are going to talk about it right now. You will tell me about you and Ryan Beck.
I don't know what...
Stop it! I know. His mother told me, Devin. Ryan's mother told me.
She's lying,
Devin said.
I don't even know her. She's lying.
Oh, to see her daughter look at her, her face so composed and lie so easily.
I saw your leotard, Devin.
I don't know what you're talking about, Mom. I don't.
Stop lying, Devin. Stop.
Her hand reached out, grabbing Devin's chin so tightly, clenching her fingers around her jaw.
Stop!
Like a pin pulled out, Devin's face seemed to collapse, her whole body sinking into itself.
Devin! Devin!
She covered her face with one hand, turning away. It all felt unfair. There'd been no ramp up to it. Her little girl, so unflappable, so self-possessed, never talked about boys. Never seemed to look at a boy, and now like a mask torn away in an instant.
I loved him, Mom. I loved him so much.
The words, just like Haley had said. Her fist covered in ice.
I got so mad I punched my own wall. I love him so much.
But Katie recognized the feeling, too. The unbearable push of feelings at that age. How she'd looked at Eric, and would have done anything at all to have him forever. Her own body feeling like it was spinning from her, unstoppable.
You make me crazy, baby. You make me crazy. I loved him,
Devin repeated. Her body so still, her voice so small.
And he's dead. And what if it's my fault?
It's not your fault, Devin,
Katie said. It seemed like she'd said it 100 times in recent days. Devin's hand fell from her face, a pale smudge in the dark of the garage. There was a long pause, like before a vault sometimes, that strange dead-eyed look. Her breath slowed to silence.
Breathing throws off your alignment, Teddy always told her. Don't breathe.
Devin, she said, what is it? You know you can tell me.
But Devin couldn't seem to speak. Her hand on her chest, a nervous gesture Katie recognized as her own. It was as if something had been undone. All that talking, the saying of things out loud, made them real. When you say it out loud, it becomes real in fresh and horrible ways.
Devin, he knows, Mom,
she blurted, eyes panicked.
Who knows? Dad!
Katie took a breath, the heat of Devin's. The closeness of the car, the smell of exhaust and chemicals.
Tell me. It was a few weeks ago,
Devin said, her hand on Katie's arm. She was ready now.
We were driving home from practice. He made me get out of the car. He sat down with me and he was so upset, Mom. He said that he knew. And it didn't matter how. He said I was throwing my life away.
Katie watched her daughter, watched her mouth moving. Words coming out. But it was like Devin herself couldn't believe each sentence until she'd uttered it, her own words terrifying her.
And he said, I needed to know the biggest mistake you could make in life is giving in to sex.
He said that to you? Katie pressed her fingers to her temples as if trying to hold her head in place.
I told him it was just for now.
Devin kept going.
That it wouldn't change anything, and he said, all the things you do at your age seem like they're just for now, but they're all forever. You live with those mistakes forever.
She looked at Katie, her voice relentless, her eyes growing wider and wider.
And then he said, Devin, there's 100 ways sex can ruin you.
A bursting in Katie's eyes, making her dizzy, her mouth thick with alcohol and exhaust. There's 100 ways sex can ruin you.
Had he really said that?
And all she could think was, what did that mean to him?
Devin. Devin, what else?
because she knew there was more, and she had to get it, all of it. And then Devin was talking again. Devin wasn't done at all.
"The day of the funeral, Mom,"
she said.
"Dad showed up at practice even though I had a ride. And when we were in the car, he said this awful thing. I can't get it out of my head."
Katie took another breath. She was thinking of him, his hands on her thighs not an hour ago, and wondering what was wrong with her. "What did he say, baby? Tell me." Her head bobbing slightly, Devin turned, and Katie watched as her eyes fixed on the door from the garage into the house. She couldn't tell what Devin was looking at. Drew's 2-liter bottle, Eric's Gore-Tex jacket slung there on a hook, dark and swelling.
"He said Ryan got what was coming to him,"
Devin whispered. So close to Katie, the words vibrated on her skin.
"That's what he said. And he said, what made that kid think he had any right?"
They locked eyes with each other.
"Devin,"
Katie said. "Look at me." But Devin couldn't, and Katie found herself getting lost in her head, too. It was as though the garage were this haunted place, the empty spot where Eric's car usually sat, like a stain beside them, like a black pit with no bottom.
"Devin," she said, forcing the words out, "do you think your father might have done something?"
With unbearable slowness, Devin turned.
"Mom, I don't know what he did,"
she said, her face assembling into something grave and hopeless.
"Do you?"
One hand on her stomach, Katie felt something pierce her, everything spilling out. She couldn't answer. Devin was saying,
"Mom, I can't go inside and see him. I can't."
And here Katie was, still drunk on his whiskey, still feeling his hands on her, back to the mattress. What was wrong with her? A red daub spreading across her collarbone where his hand had pressed. Other things she wouldn't let herself think about at all.
Who was that man? Did she even know?
You were mysterious to him, and he was mysterious to you. She put a hand on either side of Devin's face.
"He's gone," she promised. "And you're with me, and everything's going to be okay."
Devin looked at her, jaw shaking between Katie's fingers.
"Mom,"
she said, eyes filled with bright tears.
"You always give me everything."
3 a.m., 4. Sleep never came, not really. Her heart pounding, cymbals crashing inside. The photo on the bedside table, she and Eric in matching Bellstar's tracksuits, searing red, Eric smiling at the camera, Katie smiling up at him. Before she knew it, she was dragging her wedding album out from the closet, behind the boxes of baby clothes, Devin's old leotards. The pictures, fading already, those disposable cameras people used to use, all the blurred, frantic shots that captured the feeling of life better than anything else. The small catering hall, a raucous and joyous crowd of 40, kegs of summer ale, the DJ with rainbow sunglasses, everyone dancing, their faces glazed with sweat. 3 of Eric's old girlfriends came, one by one introducing themselves to Katie. "He's the greatest guy," they all said. "The one that got away. A gentleman, a sweetheart, a knight in shining armor." "And you did it. You got him. How did you?" And she never knew, not really, because yes, she was 3 months along by then, but that wasn't the reason. She'd already gone for her consultation at the Options Women's Center, listening to them describe how they would insert a tube. A suction device that will gently empty your uterus. But then Eric showed up the night before her appointment, saying he'd been driving around for hours and had come to important decisions about the things that mattered to him. And it turned out that the life inside of her, which they'd created, was the thing itself. And he'd torn the pull tab from the Schlitz can and promised her everything, always and forever.
"This must be how life really happens," he'd said. "You don't know what you're supposed to do, what your purpose is, and suddenly life tells you."
The wedding night she wasn't supposed to drink at all, but she'd had 3 glasses of champagne, and Eric 3 times that, plus tequila and Mexican cigars, and they both smelled of sweat and crushed flowers, and ended up having sex in the backseat of Eric's car in the hotel parking structure, neither able to remember what they'd done with the key card and not wanting to wait one more second, his arm under her dress up to his shoulder, and everything frenzied and luscious. And the truth was, arm hooked in his tight, she did think, I've got him now. Now he is mine. Chapter 16. Just before 5 in the purple dawn, she crept down the hall and checked on Devon sleeping, her head a dark mass on the pillow. Finally, she fell asleep herself. Now it was nearly 7, the clock radio droning with weather, traffic, her face muffled in pillows, drifting in and out, the tug of forgetting. The phone ringing, the landline again.
Did you hear?
Hear what? Katie said, her voice sleep-frogged. Who is this?
It's Helen Beck. The police called late last night to tell me about the paint chips. I can't stop thinking about it.
What?
Wait, Helen. Sitting up now, her stomach churning with last night's liquor. They found some paint chips in Ryan's clothes. Car paint. And guess what? They're not purple.
Oh,
Katie said, biting down on her finger, trying to wake herself.
They found just a few, very tiny.
What color, Helen?
So I guess that witness was wrong.
What color, Helen?
Katie said, head throbbing with the knowing.
Silver, they said. Or metallic gray.
Silver, Katie repeated.
I know, doesn't narrow things down much. The detective told me there's more than 6,000 silver or gray cars in this county alone.
I see them everywhere,
Katie said, her mouth dry.
Silver to match your eyes, she'd said when Eric first drove it home a half dozen years ago, and he'd grinned.
My eyes are gray.
But the yellow ring around the center always made them glitter.
So what does that mean?
Katie asked. What comes next?
The state crime lab maybe can identify the make and model of the car from the samples. Sometimes they can do that.
Make and model. That limits it a little, but
I'm optimistic. I have to be. He's my boy, she said.
There was a pause, Katie already on her feet, the cord wreathed with dust tangling up her legs.
Katie, I bet we're both sorry about the other day, Helen kept talking. Mothers, you know? When they're born, we grow a new set of teeth. What's that line? There ought to be a law against a mother like that.
I have to go, Helen.
I guess I'm glad to know it wasn't his girlfriend, she said, taking a breath. It was just some random monster.
Stumbling into the bathroom, Katie ducked her head under the sink faucet, gulping hungrily.
Silver, gray, metallic.
Her head clunking and clanking from one image to the next, like coins jangling against each other.
Silver, gray, metallic, like coins, melted coins.
Drew's fever-streaked palm opened before as they stood in the garage, and the three silver specks stippled in the center. She stood in the garage, barefoot, wearing only Eric's Bellstars booster T-shirt, eyes on the greasy blot where his car was usually parked. Kneeling, one hand holding back the bowing handle of the rusting lawnmower, its wheels turning, she used the light from her phone to look. Down on her knees now, fingers spreading, she searched, even in the crease between the concrete and the garage wall. There was nothing glinting. The greasy blot, though. She crawled over to it. At night it had looked like a pit. Now she could smell something. Motor oil and something else.
I saved them!
Show me, she said.
He pointed to his window, a piece of scotch tape, a few inches long, sealed diagonally across the pane. It was only when she walked right up to the sill that she could see them, three hard sparkles, one as large as a dime, the sun perforating the center. Her arm stretched, she tore off the tape and crumpled it into her palm.
It's not safe, she said. There's lead in it.
He looked at her.
Like in the school basement?
He asked after a few seconds.
They used the big vacuum cleaner. They wore these white spacesuits and big masks.
Are you sure you didn't dream that?
Katie said, rolling the tape tighter and tighter in her palm.
You always think I dream things that were real. They came when we were at the meet after Halloween. The one far away.
We didn't get back in time to empty out my cubby. The Parthenon got ruined.
Oh, Drew, yes, Katie said. That was rotten.
Drew's prize-winning sugar cube Parthenon. The same kind she'd made when she was in fourth grade more than a quarter century ago. Like his sister, he did everything with precision, until his hands were hard with glue. The entire drive home after the meet, she and Eric kept promising they'd make it back in time.
We'll rescue the Parthenon, kiddo, Eric said, pounding on the gas.
By the time they got home, the remediation workers had thrown it away, dumped it in a bin behind the school.
I'm sorry, honey, she said now.
We all felt really bad about it. Drew didn't say anything, just looked back up at the window, the sticky streak where the tape had been.
Drew,
she said, looking at his digital clock.
Where's Devon?
School,
he said.
Mrs. Chu came and got her. She said you needed to sleep and to let you.
Drew, she said, rolling the tape in her hand until it was fine as wire.
Go watch TV. Watch anything you want. Mom has to work.
It was as if her body was moving on its own, pure muscle memory.
Later, she would wonder why she didn't even hesitate. Standing over the sink, she tore every bit of the tape off her fingers where it stuck glue-thick to her nails, the sound of her own breaths like an animal. The garbage disposal hummed and grinded, and then she wondered if it would be enough. Would the tape, like potato peels, celery string, grip and line the pipes, stay there forever?
Devon, you okay?
Yes,
she texted back.
Have you heard from your dad?
Don't want to talk about Dad.
I'm coming to get you.
Mom, no, I want to be here.
Everything will be okay, Dee.
Okay, Mom.
It was all adrenaline, blood. Breathe in, breathe out. Back downstairs, turning on her laptop, nearly shaking it to life.
Eric had taken the car to the shop. Which day had that been? Was it a tune-up? A cranking sound? The alternator again?
There were always car problems, both their Fords gasping past 100,000 miles, countless out-of-state meets, the daily sojourns to and from school, gym, booster meetings.
She couldn't recall seeing his car the day they learned about Ryan. Katie had driven them all to practice in her old war horse, Eric decamping to a nearby diner with his laptop. All she could remember was his car. Was it in the shop the day of Ryan's funeral, and when she came home after she'd found Eric in the garage, the car returned.
And the garage. Hadn't it smelled of something? Solvent or aerosol? Or was it paint?
She tried to log on to their credit card sites, but she didn't know the passwords. Eric paid those bills. She didn't know anything.
Click-clicking, palm wet and sticky, she tried to open his email. Incorrect password.
It had been Elite D for years. The only password they ever used, but now it didn't work. One by one, she yanked open all the warping plywood drawers of the desk, paper wafting. Booster minutes, work orders, credit card bills, mortgage statements, past dues. One drawer glided free, landing on the floor, releasing something. It fell to the carpet. Tented there. A creased Father's Day card from years before. An illustration of a card deck on the cover.
I was dealt to be your daughter. You were dealt to be my dad. No matter how the game turns out, you're the best hand I ever had.
Bottom drawer, a fat stack of receipts, gym dues, meet fees, furnace maintenance, last week's dinner at the Wooden Nickel. She sat down at the swivel chair, breathing. Then she bent down to pick up the greeting card, her foot hitting something, the shredder bin under the desk. She dragged the bin toward her and overturned it, knocking the cross-cut shredder onto the carpet. Over and over she plunged her hands through the confettied shards, nicking her knuckles once, twice, until she found it. A pink paper corner, the staple trapped between the shredder blades, Brigand's Collision. It wasn't a place she knew. Not the Firestone they usually went to. Brigand's Collision. Reardon. Reardon. Which was 47 miles away. It took her a long time to free the pink paper from the keen blades of the shredder. But she did. Quarter panel. $400 plus... Another shard read. Cash. She placed it in the center of the desk. Bent her shoulders forward.
as if her body had lost its bones. That's how it felt. One too many shocks to her shocked system. She could no longer tense, no longer charge forward, no longer do anything. Her body was sinking back into itself like a slime-thick snail, hiding. 17 years of knowing him. The particular softness of the inside of his wrists, the way he whistled whenever he walked into a bank, the precise choreography of his fingers when he wanted her to turn over in bed. Devin, do you think your father might have done something? I don't know what he did. Do you? None of this, she said to herself, again and again, was Eric. This was not Eric. Except there was this. He would always do anything for her, wouldn't he? For Devin. Trampolines, second mortgages, booster president. Gwen, the new equipment, the pit, the righteous emails he wrote to unfair judges but never sent. Shouting down a heckler in the stands, and again in the parking lot. And yet sometimes he still seemed surprised by the power and weight of feelings she could stir in him. The anger when she was criticized, the awe when she performed.
I didn't hear him,
Lacey had said.
But Devin kept saying, Dad, Dad, don't cry. Don't.
And what made that kid think he had any right? So many things you never think you'll do until you do them. She stared into the shredder bin, the pink accordion snares of the receipt in her hand. If someone taped them together, they could still figure it all out, couldn't they? And surely Brigham's Collision had another copy, the original. And signs on the car, telltale clues, faint ridges that spoke of new paint, patches like the surface of an orange peel, like the time they'd had their bumper repaired. Everything was there, if someone wanted to look. She picked up the bin and thrust it under her arm, carried it to the sink, and lit a kitchen match, watching the pink tatters burn. After she turned on the faucet, the ashes sinking down the drain. She thought about the piece of scotch tape, the paint chips on it. She should have burned it, too. There might be microscopic pieces left in the drain. You could never hide everything. Lying on the bed, the lights off, the ceiling fan burring softly, she tried to make the pieces fit together. Could you recall the details of a random night in your family life? She wondered, as if there were a you to hear it. Time passed, hollowed out, and she tried to do something akin to meditation, self-hypnosis, a trance like at slumber parties as a kid. That night, the night Ryan died. Everyone was tired and frantic. Everyone was always tired and frantic. Lacey's birthday invitation had threatened pedicures, pottery painting, and pedi-fours. And Katie remembered hunting for wrapping paper, worrying over the gift, a desk lamp that looked like a gummy bear, a pair of glitter bracelets, because Gwen's daughter didn't want for anything as long as Gwen wanted it too. Devin, exhausted from the flip-into-spring invitational, her face with that kind of numb glaze, could barely tie her tennis shoes. "I'm gonna walk," she said. "I don't need a ride. It's not that far." "Okay, but call us when you're ready to leave. It'll be dark." And Eric, most of his sleep lost that week getting Devin to practice by 6 a.m., was hunched over his laptop, headphones on, dark pouches under his eyes, old coffee on one side of him, and a warming liter of diet soda on the other. Katie had taken Drew to the mall for rock salt, right? And run into Kirsten Seaford in the parking lot on her way to Lacey's. In the back seat, barely visible behind the raffia and cellophane, her daughter Jordan held a colossal spa birthday basket suited for a Beverly Hills Grand Dame. "I hope the party goes long. Greg's taking me to Randello's for dinner," Kirsten had whispered in Katie's ear, her hair stiff with spray, an energy on her. "But you've seen the way he eats. We'll be home by 9. 8 if he starts ordering Jack and Coke." At home, she'd lost an hour or two helping Drew with his science project, the shrimp eggs and the salt, salvaging a 2-liter from the neighbor's recycling bin, slicing the top off to serve as a hatchery, filling it with salt water, standing on a kitchen chair. Drew sprinkled the shrimp eggs, glossy little beads the size of pinheads inside. "Did Devin call?" Eric had asked, vague tang of beer on his breath. Right, he'd had a beer at dinner, and another while he watched, standing at the kitchen counter. The Junior Olympics National Invitational on one of the ESPNs. He'd drunk it guiltily, greedily, looking tired. All the adrenaline from the meet, from Devon's win, from everything. Or was he thinking of Devon and Ryan? Was he thinking of them constantly since he'd found out? "I thought you'd want me to pick her up by now," he'd said, watching Katie mop the briny water from the counter, the kitchen floor, the dining room table, even the back of Drew's neck.
"They have to sit for 3 days, Mom," Drew had said, "to see how many die."
She told him to put the hatchery in the basement of the garage or it'd get knocked over and she'd be cleaning up salt water for days. Then she began gathering laundry, hand-washing Devon's competition leotard in the sink. But where was Eric? The TV was on. Everyone's computer humming. The blip of cell phones. Everyone in a different corner. He must have put Drew to bed. She didn't remember that. There was a whole pocket of the evening she couldn't be sure Eric had been there at all. The next time she looked at her watch, it was nearly 11, and she ran down the basement stairs to throw a clot of crusted dish rags in the washer, the final load. And she'd finally heard the door from the garage slam, heard Devon pounding up the stairs, the shower turn on. She'd knocked on her bedroom door at one point, said goodnight.
"Night, Mom."
"Night." She and Eric often didn't go to bed at the same time. They almost never did. Then the part she remembered. 2 a.m. A tunnel of sleep and Eric reaching over, pressing against the small of her back, his fingers digging into the base of her spine, then climbing under her t-shirt, urgent and insistent. Her demon lover. What had he just done? She felt her stomach turn.
"I promise I'm okay."
"Really, Mom?" Katie sat on the edge of her bed, phone in hand. It wasn't yet 9 o'clock in the morning, and she was already so tired she couldn't imagine standing or putting on clothes. "I'll get you after last period. Do not leave with anyone else."
"Okay."
"This is Mrs. Knox. I'm calling to make a special request. Devon's father, he's on medication, back pain."
It was so easy to lie. "He's not supposed to be driving, but he's very stubborn."
"Sounds like my husband,"
the school secretary said with a sigh.
"If he shows up, I don't want him to leave with Devon."
"Mr. Knox? Really?"
"He just doesn't seem to be able to take it easy," Katie said, forcing a wry tone.
"It's strong stuff he's on, and he just can't be trusted right now."
"Of course, Mrs. Knox.
He's not himself."
Part 4. But I sometimes wonder, to this day, if courage is just another word for desperation. Nadia Komenich, Letters to a Young Gymnast. Chapter 17. She didn't hear the car pull up the driveway. She was on her hands and knees in the garage, looking for more paint chips, for glass. All she could see was the long trail of rock salt from Drew's first failed science project. The garage door was open only a foot when she spotted the cuffs of a man's suit pants, a pair of scuffed wingtips. The shoes paused a second, then kept walking. A second later, the doorbell rang. Katie looked down at herself, t-shirt, her bare legs, knees covered in garage floor grime, dirt and dust flecked. Through the frosted panel on one side of the front door, she saw the car in the driveway, a black Dodge. Moving to the other panel, she spotted the two men on the porch, both in suits. One had a phone clipped to his belt. Had they heard her in the garage? Seen her feet? The buzzer became a knock. She could hear the cackle of a two-way radio through the door.
"Ma'am?"
a voice came.
"Ma'am, I'm Detective Renton. This is Detective Fury. Can we speak to you?"
3 minutes later, after throwing on a pair of Devon's workout capris swiped from the laundry basket, streaking a dish towel up and down her arms, across her face even, she opened the door.
"I'm sorry," she said. "My son is very sick."
"We're sorry to bother you at home, Mrs. Knox," said the younger one, Detective Fury.
Or Fury? Had that really been his name?
The detective settled into the slow, sinking sofas across from Katie in the wing chair, which still seemed to bear the scent of Gwen from days before, tuberose and musk. The chair she and Eric had once copulated on. That's the word that came to her soiled brain. Copulated. Animals. But she needed to focus. She needed to...
Is Mr. Knox here?
Detective Renton asked. And there it was.
He's at work.
The way they were watching her, she wondered how tight the capris were, how her face looked. Her hand went to her forehead, the slick of sweat there. Had she even brushed her teeth?
What can I help you with? She said. What is it you want?
Mrs. Knox, are you okay?
Yes,
she said, breathing from the center, like Coach T always told Devin to do.
Breathe, focus, let go. Breathe, believe, and battle.
But my son has scarlet fever. You probably shouldn't be here.
I'm sorry about your son, Mrs. Knox, Renton said. But don't worry about us. We're strong like bulls.
He tried to smile or do something with his face.
This won't take long,
said the young one, Fury, with the freshly shaved neck, pink and angry. But his voice was gentle.
We just have a few follow-up questions.
Questions?
How's your daughter doing?
The hover of relief in her throat made it hard to talk. The locker room fight, of course.
She's fine,
Katie said, folding her hands, resting them on her thighs, the slippery spandex of Devon's capris a half foot too short for her. As fine as can be expected.
That's good news, said Fury, very earnest.
He was just a boy, really, the Adam's apple, the razor marks on his neck. Officer Fury, boy detective.
I'm sure you heard, Detective Renton said. Miss Belfour has been under 24-hour psychiatric care since the incident.
Yes, we were very glad.
Well, it looks like she's going home today,
he said, and then paused.
Really?
She said. They both seemed to be watching her so closely, even leaning forward, scrutinizing. Were there paint chips under her fingernails? Maybe a ribbon of half-shredded evidence stuck to her foot bottom. Pink slivers of the repair receipt clinging to her ankles. You could never hide it all.
So we'll be talking to Miss Belfour again about what happened,
Renton continued, watery eyes on her.
After the incident, she wasn't too coherent, and after her attorney arrived, well, she wasn't talking anymore.
Wait,
Katie said, her voice squeaking like the uneven bars. Like Devon's hands gripping the fiberglass, body swinging, chalk spraying.
Wait, I don't understand. She's a criminal. She attacked my little girl. You're charging her, right?
They both looked at her.
There haven't been any charges yet,
Renton said, voice even.
Before we submit our report to the DA, we need to follow up on a few things we've learned.
What things? Katie said. Why had they come here anyway, instead of calling her to the station? And wasn't it odd that they just stopped by unannounced? Renton, with his gravelly voice and his worn skin like an old potato, right alongside Fury, with his delicate boy face. And was one the good cop and one the bad? The thought came to her.
What happened to Officer Crandall? He was the one we spoke to after my daughter was attacked. Wasn't this his case?
The two men looked at her, Fury's forehead crinkling gently. Then, the squawk of her phone upstairs, those stroking first beats of Assassin's Tango.
Excuse me.
She leaped to her feet, moving quickly to the stairs.
If that's your husband, Mrs. Knox, Renton called out. We'd like to speak to him, too. He works out of that studio over on Marriott Road, right?
Gwen,
she whispered, shutting the upstairs bathroom door behind her, making sure no one could hear.
I can't talk now.
She never would have answered if it weren't for the detectives, their starchy blue shirts and thick-soled shoes. The squinting of their eyes and the leaning closer. She needed some space, some time to think.
Katie, Gwen was saying, already mid-harangue, I'd like you to reconsider your position here. Even if you want Devon home, that doesn't mean she can't continue her sessions at M-Power.
That's not going to happen, and I can't talk.
Because in a month, your daughter will step out onto the competition floor and have what could be her last chance at qualifying for elite, after the catastrophe of 2 years ago.
I'm not discussing this with you,
Katie said, her hands on the sink, sticky from something. Soap? Last night's noxious whiskey?
This has nothing to do with you.
Well, that's just false. I'm the treasurer of this entire operation. Devon's success or failure will have a major impact on the finances of this gym.
I don't care about the gym's goddamn finances.
Trying to keep her voice low, the silence from downstairs. Those detectives, could they hear?
The Boosters have invested a great deal in Devon, Gwen continued, and her fate affects our daughters too. Do you see what I'm saying?
Leaning against the peeling vanity, Katie turned on the water so they couldn't hear. The old mold-thick vents might just muffle the telltale heart. Those detectives down there. Surely Haley had told them about Devon and Ryan. And if she hadn't told before, what would stop her from telling now? And then they would talk to Eric, and want to see Eric's car, and...
Katie, do you see? Are you there? I can hear your anxious little breaths.
I'm hanging up.
Katie, were you an athlete?
No, she said, wanting to scream at Gwen and fearing the detectives could hear. Imagining them both leaning forward, craning necks.
Who is she talking to? Is that her daughter? Her husband?
Of course you weren't. I don't know what you wanted at Devon's age, Katie. But I'd bet my daughter's college fund you couldn't name it then or now. But Devon is different. She knows what she wants. She's not like the rest of us, Katie.
Who the hell do you think you are?
Katie whispered, her mouth pressed against the phone.
Slinking into our lives with your snakeskin shoes and your big checkbook and your...
You wanted that checkbook, didn't you? She said icily.
Downstairs, Katie thought she heard footsteps. She thought about the door to the garage. About what else might be in there. Glass fragments. The microscopic residue of paint. Flakes and chips too small for the eye to see. But they would see.
This isn't about your maternal vanity, Gwen was saying. It's about your daughter.
In her head, Katie was screaming. The water running, she leaned down as close to the rush of it all as she could and said through gritted teeth,
Go to hell! You go to hell!
But nothing ever touched Gwen.
Because, Katie, there's nothing on God's green earth I wouldn't do for my child, Gwen said. The bastioned fortress in the center of an impassable moat. That's something Eric and I agree on. Don't you? What kind of mother wouldn't?
What kind of mother?
To say that to Katie, who'd given every waking hour and every sleeping hour to her daughter, who sat in that gym every day,
spent hundreds of hours in backless bleachers, elbows perpetually rubbed raw from all the bleacher leaning, who drove as many as 30 hours a week, who spent hours hunting for lost grips or a favorite leotard, every leotard costing more than any item of clothing Katie had, who hadn't had a professional haircut in 4 years, who'd never been on a trip alone with her husband at all, her only vacations consisting of free hours torn from tournament weekends, her shoulder bag filled with water bottles and ibuprofen and gluey hair gel and sharp bobby pins and lucky grips and the right kind of energy bars you could only get online and the right kind of athletic tape, and the lucky socks, and the lucky hairbrush, and Devon's inhaler and her backup inhaler, her hands resting on Devon's weary shoulders as they tromped through the museum, the science center, the amusement park, and the 45 minutes they had to spare before practice.
I refuse to deprive my daughter of the opportunity to achieve her dreams, Gwen continued, unrelenting. I will not give up on her. Will you give up on Devon?
You're lucky I didn't call the goddamned police, Katie said instead, jaw grinding. You took my daughter!
The police? There was a brief pause. Then Gwen's voice returned, grim and precise.
You don't want to call the police.
Something in her tone. Something with portent. Whatever it meant, Katie could not hear it now.
I'll do whatever I need to do to protect my daughter, Katie said. And hung up.
Walking down the stairs, she dragged down the hems of the capris, smoothed her hair.
I'm sorry,
she said, returning to the living room, blood high and with new purpose.
but it's not a good time.
The detectives looked up at her, half rising, then sitting again.
We get that a lot, Renton said, trying for a smile.
Instead of sitting, Katie rested her hands on the back of the wing chair, hiding her shaking legs behind it. We already told Officer Crandall everything we know, and we're a sick house. We're a sick house. Her words sounded funny to her, but they seemed to have weight, impact, that big way of talking. She'd never tried it before. Nothing on God's green earth I wouldn't do for my child.
Mrs. Knox, Fury said, his neck less pink now, expression oddly tender.
We do understand. We're here to help you.
She felt very tall. The detective slunk so low on the ancient Sears sofa. She straightened her back. She would be ready this time.
We reviewed security camera footage of the gym lobby, Renton said. And you can clearly see Miss Belfour following your daughter into the locker room.
She was hunting her, Katie said, like my daughter was some kind of animal.
But you should know Miss Belfour's injuries far outweighed your daughter's, Renton added.
My daughter's strong. She knows how to defend herself, thank God.
Her spine tight and taut, nothing they said touched her. It was like the rival gym parents at the meets, the way they would talk, trying to diminish Devon's achievements, cast doubt, noting the extra time Coach T gave her, the special privileges. You had to be above all of that, or trample it under your feet.
And you?
Fury said, lifting his pen in the air, pointing it in her direction.
You too, Mrs. Knox. You defended yourself. Are those from Miss Belfour, too?
She followed his pen to her forearm, bare, the brown serrations etching that fishhook scratch, elbow to wrist. Conscious of the gaping armholes of Eric's shirt, air-hitting skin, their eyes on her, her marks.
Of course they are. You see what Haley's capable of, then, she said, discreetly displaying her forearm.
Fury looked at it, noted it.
Mrs. Knox, Renton said, have your daughter and Miss Belfour been involved in any back and forth? A kind of feud? There was talk of texts exchanged. Girls can...
No, absolutely not. And by the way, Haley's not a girl. She's the adult who attacked my child, a minor. That's what we're talking about, right?
Right.
And she's the adult whose car was seen at the site of her boyfriend's deadly accident, correct?
That's a separate investigation, Mrs. Knox.
And as for talking to my husband, he wasn't there when my daughter was assaulted. I was. And I will tell you again what you already know, what a dozen people saw.
She felt something stirring powerfully in her, and the words just came, her finger poking at them like Coach on the floor.
To stick it, you gotta grind those baby girl heels of yours. Hand on the vault, punching every word. When it hurts, you know you've landed it right.
That 23-year-old woman, half a foot taller with at least 30 pounds on my child, a woman with a history of instability and juvenile delinquency, tackled her, pounded her head into the floor, wrapped her hands around my baby's throat. That's what matters. And that's why you're here, isn't it? Because we don't live in a place where adults are allowed to beat on children.
Watching her, Detective Renton jiggled a pen on his knee. One of their radios crackled. It didn't matter that there'd been no head pounding, no hands to throat. Not like some of the fights she'd seen, long ago waiting tables at the Magic Stick the summer after high school. Or the woman who'd bushwhacked her mom in the parking lot for giving her phone number to her husband. Her keys had been between her fingers, ready to pounce. With Haley and Devon, it was more chaotic, all elbows and knees and squeaking sneaker soles. It was blood and nails and teeth. But Devon knew how to take hits, had been taking them most of her life, chin to beam, knee to mat. The red marks from Haley's hoodie cord embedded in her palm were no worse than any day's gym rips, than anything that might happen to Devon, whose body was so constantly tested, battered, shocked. You should know that Haley Belfour has always been jealous of my daughter, she went on, her voice gaining still more energy, hands gripping the back of that ridiculous chair, still smelling of Gwen's tube rose. Gwen was everywhere.
of Devon's talents, the attention she receives from Haley's uncle, from everyone. You see, Haley was never a real gymnast herself. She was too big, too graceless. Maybe she watched my daughter and saw what might have been 10 years ago if she'd been a less troubled girl. If she'd had the discipline, but also the innate talent, the thing Devon has that makes her exceptional.
Miss Knox, I...
A grown woman so jealous of a child that she physically attacks her. Can you imagine the rage inside? What do you think a woman like that is capable of?
She looked at them. They looked at her.
But this is something we've dealt with Devon's entire life.
The envy of others. Chapter 18. The detectives were still standing in her driveway, talking. She watched from the window, watched how closely they stood, and how near the garage. Fury was nodding at everything Renton was saying, his mouth moving ceaselessly. Then she saw them looking across her lawn, to Mr. Watts' fading ranch house, the driveway. Mr. Watts was there, the hood of his green Impala open, doing one of his endless repairs. They walked over to him. They said something to him, and he looked up, his old aviators flashing. She imagined what he might say.
"On the garage floor, detective. The boy thought they were silverfish. Yes, I showed them to Mrs. Knox. Later, I thought, oh, paint from her husband's car. Yes, it's that color exactly. She must have thought the same thing."
She watched as Mr. Watts shook his head, then shook it again. Then they left.
"Mr. Watts," she said, her feet still bare, soles sunk in dew. "Were they bothering you?"
"Nope," he said, wiping his hands with an oil-soft rag. "Were they bothering you?"
"But what did they ask you?"
He paused, looking at her, those aviators reflecting herself back in both mirrored teardrops.
"If I had a permit for my RV," he said, "what'd they ask you?"
"I'm sorry," she said. "Someone's been harassing Devon. It's very upsetting, and I'm very upset."
He nodded, folding his arms.
"That is upsetting," he said. "I hope they're helping you. Your daughter's in the paper so much now. That brings out the crazy."
"Yes," Katie said, catching a glimpse of her drawn face in his sunglasses. "It does."
"I always try to keep an eye out for all of you. I still think about Devon's accident. Things like that can do bad things to a family."
Katie nodded. It had happened soon after they'd moved in, and they barely knew Mr. Watts, but he'd run over to help. Leaning down, he tried to talk to little Devon.
"What's your favorite ice cream?"
Anything to distract her from the blood and chaos, the smell of gas, the shrieking lawnmower.
"I'll never forget seeing you at the screen door before it happened," he said now, pointing up the driveway. "I was out there in my garage and saw you watching her run out to her daddy."
Standing at the door?
The way she remembered it, she went to the door only after hearing Devon screech, like a cat caught in a hunting trap.
"What a thing," he said. "It was like you were frozen. Like ice."
The sexy slashing violin thrusts. Her phone again. Those opening jabs of Assassin's Tango. That song, the one from the Spring Invitational, Devon performing her floor routine to its slinks and jabs the day Ryan died. The slippery magenta of her leotard, her buttocks high, those hard-hewn legs, muscles grooved and bronzed, undulating under her leotard with every move, the staccato march of her colt legs, the sharpness of the foot flick, the haughtiness of the head snap. The slow glides. There had been something different in it, in that performance. At the time, Katie hadn't been able to put her finger on it. Now it seemed so clear. That hip swing, slow and mesmerizing. Then down on the mat, lolling and rolling, the straddle, thump, thump, whip, snap, the purr of her feet. Earthy, carnal. My God, how had she missed it? All the clues right there. Before, Devon had always been so intent on her performance, the physics of it, the aerodynamic logic of it. It never even seemed like she heard the music at all. But that day, Katie realized, it was as if Devon really heard it, moved with it, and in it. And her body was no longer a machine, a tool, a weapon, but a body, moving.